The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from filmmaker and mountaineer David Brashears.
We are so honored today to have with us Mr. David Brashears. David is one of the greatest mountaineers in history. He's an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and a best-selling author. David has made 8 expeditions to Mount Everest and has reached the summit 5 times. He was on the mountain this April when the devastating earthquake shook Nepal and triggered the avalanche that struck base camp. David is the first American to reach the summit twice. He is the first American ever to broadcast live from the summit of Mount Everest. He is the first person to record IMAX images of Mount Everest. In May of 1996, David was at Everest with his IMAX crew, filming his first IMAX movie, when a devastating storm hit the mountain while 35 climbers were attempting the summit. David stopped his expedition, closed down his filming project, and devoted himself and his entire crew to saving the lives of those climbers on Mount Everest. And that is the subject of the current film in theaters right now called Everest, of which David is an executive producer of that film. David has received 4 Emmys for his achievements in cinematography. David contributed photos to the best-selling book Everest, Mountain Without Mercy. He was the director and producer of the Nova television program Everest, The Death Zone, and which featured David Carter's successful summit of the mountain. David is the author of several books, including an autobiography and a 2000 film documentary, Storm Over Everest, which is shown on the PBS program Frontline. Perhaps most important recently to David, he is the founder of Glacier Works, a non-for-profit that is raising awareness on the effects of climate change in the greater Himalayan region, and that is what he is spending most of his time on these days. It is a privilege to have with us today one of the legendary explorers of our time. Please welcome Mr. David Brashears.
Well, thank you, Matt. I'm going to push this out of the way so I can see people. I have a couple of microphones here. It's really wonderful to be here. The Economic Club of Indiana. One of the primary reasons I'm here is because of my dear and beloved friend, David Carter. We were on Everest in 1997. We reached the summit together on May 23rd, 1997. I've been out to Indianapolis several times. I know your city fairly well. I was here for the Everest IMAX film release, Kilimanjaro, and for a Nova special called Into the Death Zone, and David was in that film, but I want David to stand up, and I want to see where he is out there, because I want to make sure he's here, first of all. Hey, David. And by the way, thanks to David's efforts and many of the people at this table and in this wonderful city, we had a very successful fundraiser for earthquake relief last night at the Indiana Historical Society, and through prior pledges and pledges received from that event, we have now raised how much? Over $50,000. Yeah. So I have been tweeting questions forever to myself. One of them says, I met you several years ago, David. Why are you dyeing your hair gray now? I want to look more sophisticated and dignified. So I have limited time here, so I have this thing, this timer. I'm going to start it. It starts to shout obscenities at me and everything if I don't stop on time. So there we go. Normally this presentation takes an hour, so I'm going to go through some things very quickly. In fact, since I've had to shorten it, there's some things I'm going to read from here. Because the takeaway from this isn't about climbing a mountain. I'm going to tell you a story of being on Everest in 1996. But there's a whole subtext there, because it's just people like us who have aspirational goals and dreams and run businesses and raise families that also decide to climb mountains. They're really not any special breed of a person. I was born and raised in Wyoming, grew up in Colorado, live in Boston, but I just had a dream and I wanted to climb that mountain since I was 11 years old and saw a picture of Tenzing Norgay on the summit. So it's really a story about leadership and team building and human character and the idiosyncrasies and the peculiarities of human behavior under stress that I want to talk to you about today. And the mountain, when you're in a storm, as you'll see, and things go wrong, it's kind of like we're all kind of onions, and you start pulling away all the layers in all that hardship and all those deprivations, and you find out a lot about yourself, and you find out a lot about your companions. And since I've been doing this since I was 23 years old, when I first went to Nepal in 1979, as a mountaineer, then later becoming a filmmaker, I've been on 50 or 60 expeditions, so I've led, and I've been led. And you learn more about leadership by being led than by leading. So for some reason, it's a complete mystery to me. I've now have an appointment of senior lecturer in leadership at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And I don't know why they gave that to me, except that what I learned was up there on that mountain, and I learned in those 60 expeditions from the mistakes too numerous to mention. And that is really, really, I look at us and I look at this room full of people, and we share so much in common. And one thing that we all share is that we're essentially in the face of nature's wrath very frail, but also we're infallible and we're imperfect. And once you realize that about yourself, it's a source of strength. It's not a source of weakness. We go out into this world and we make mistakes. And how we take ownership of those mistakes and not try to project the aura of perfection and know-it-all-ism to the people around us. I have found in following people, I follow that person more than the perfect person, because the perfect person isn't taking in information that I need them to have to make me safe in my world. So here's some takeaway I'm going to have to read from this, because I've shortened my normal leadership talk a bit. Do you mind if I read it very quickly? Okay. The one thing I've learned in the mountains when things change, and things changed a lot in 1996, they've changed a lot for me in many endeavors, just as they have for you. We have a plan, we start out, things don't go right. But along the way, even if things start to fail, maintaining the integrity of the mission is something that you can really find as a source of strength. You hang on, you cling to what you set out to do from the beginning. And you might change that plan, you might change your team missions, but as long as you remember the integrity of that mission and why you set out to do it, we never forgot in 1996, after 8 people died, we were there to get an IMAX camera to the top of Everest, and we got it to the top. So mission integrity. Also, another thing I'll just throw in here, you know, I've been too many times in a mountain where someone wanted me to do something that wasn't safe or the weather had gone wrong, and they said, well, we're going up the mountain, and I said, why? And the leader said, because it's the plan. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. Plans don't think. You think. So why are we following the plan if it doesn't think? And so we also have a tendency to rely on things that we've written and want to follow and lead. And we give ownership of our own kind of worldview, which that changes so frequently, our worldview, to adapt, not our core values, but the way that we perceive the world in order to modify and adapt to an ever-changing world. And a plan doesn't do that. But the plan does have initial integrity, that it was built on what you were trying to achieve. When you look for teammates and when you look to yourself, I want teammates that are selfless. I won't tolerate a selfish teammate. They're dangerous to the team. and especially when you're up there in that environment. I want commitment from team members and from the leader. I want conviction, and I want them to care about what we're doing. A leader has to say, what are we doing? How are we going to do it? And more importantly, why does it matter? Because I'm not going to follow anyone anywhere if they can't tell me why it matters. If you can tell me why it matters and get me on your side, I'll crawl through mud for you. But my mud is up there at 29,000 feet. I'll get the camera to the top for you, but you got to tell me why it matters. The leader sets the tone through his or her virtues and example. The fish rots from the head down. We all know that. Tone is important. Are you a dismissive, abusive leader? Are you a caring leader? Do you provide psychological safety for your team? And that's not a pat on the back and a hug all the time, because superficial praise is the worst kind of praise of all. It's just that I care for you. This, we will protect you as we move through whatever endeavor it is together. And believe me, my work is no, I don't consider any more difficult or challenging than your work, except in my work, when things go wrong, people can die. So that leads to another thing here. We often go out into the world as leaders and even teammates with good intent. Never confuse good intent with good leadership. You'll see a man in the film who cared about a companion a lot, a client, and led him to the top of Everest too late and set off a cascade of events where people died. His intent was good. He cared about that man. He cared too much about that man. And yet they're all dead on the mountain. And they're still there as I speak. And that was 1996. So I think I said it also last night about at the fundraiser about giving money. Like, you know, when we receive money for our work, earthquake relief, that's your goodwill. But it doesn't, we have to execute. You know, just because we say we want to give that money away, we have to give it away in a very thoughtful and careful manner. So goodwill is not enough. Execution. Another small thing here is, this is something that you'll see in the film and you'll see here, is willful ignorance of negative information. And this is something that we're one of our most deep-seated sort of components of our humanity, is that when we set out on a task, we get into a place which is called escalation of commitment. And to summarize that in my own terms, it's called sunk cost, but that's a technical term. I have what I call David's sunk cost: pride, ego, money, time, and energy. And so the further we get along in a task or executing a plan, the closer the finish line, the less prone we are to bring in negative information to tell us why it's not going to work. We want information that's going to tell us why it's going to work. And you can't do that on a mountain. You know, when I leave the high camp, or even every time I approach Everest, I approach it anew. I want to be fresh to that mountain. I want to understand the threats that have always been there that I never understood, because one person can't understand everything. And to surround myself with the best possible teammates that see things that I don't see. But when you get to the end, always remember, especially if things are falling apart and we don't want to admit failure, then we become very dangerous to ourselves and dangerous to our teammates. But being able to have a leader that has provided a psychological security for you to admit that it's not working. I shouldn't have used the word failure. Sorry. So because something's not working doesn't mean it's a failure. There were maybe forces involved that you could not have understood in the beginning. And that's the way it is. Even when I try to deal with my young son, it's like, wow, thought I had that all figured out. Last thing. The leaders, one of your most profound obligations, besides never willfully abusing or diminishing those around you, is to know your world. You know, there's a lot of ways to make money fast in the world, and there's a lot of ways to make money that takes a lot into the pipeline. And when I followed people on that mountain for years, is actually 13 expeditions and other expeditions, then I want that person to know their world, and I want them to know it daily. I want them to be taking information. Leaders have that responsibility. And if you don't want that responsibility to be curious and have energy, then you shouldn't take on that position of being a leader, because we see from our research that some of the best leaders are really deeply curious people. You got to know more than, because so many factors in the world will affect how your product, your entity, what you're presenting is received. So it's just not knowing your world, but also knowing the world. And you do that by reading a lot, of course, and staying curious, and most importantly, staying open-minded. Because closed minds are not receptive to information, but it's very easy to have a closed mind, because you don't have to think. You just stay with what you know. So I try not to do that on the mountain, and now we're going to fly through this presentation in world record time, because I wasn't going to come and just speak to you about Mount Everest. I felt a group this illustrious and leaders in your field, you might have a few takeaways from what I just mentioned. Now I want to introduce you to the mountain where I kind of grew up on. Since I was 23 years old, I was there when the earth started shaking and 18 people died at base camp. Our camp was in the center of the massive wind blast that destroyed part of base camp. But remarkably, although people over in that corner there, we lost 6 people there from a team over there, 4 over there, 3. No one was even injured in our camp, probably because its position in a small depression. The wind blast that was over 330 miles an hour stripped our camp away, but people were left unscathed. So from 1981, when I first went there for ABC Sports, until this year, well, yes, that's 34 years of my life on this mountain. So now if we bring down these lights here just a little bit, because you really don't need to pay, that's perfect, then I'm going to have you watch something that we've made from our work at Glacier Works, and we're going to do something. We are flying through data. It's not a movie. It's not CGI. It's real pixels. And so here's Welcome to Mount Everest. You know what? I still like that every time I see it, because it's it just makes the mountain look so big and glorious, and you understand now its size and shape. So while I bring up the program here, it'll just give me a second here to launch it. Now we're going to get into the program, go up Everest. So it still would benefit probably the audience and even me if you brought the lights back down to where they were. Really, I'm a filmmaker. So I tell stories in the dark. So you don't need, you really, it's all about the screen. So go ahead and bring the lights down again. Very quickly, 1996, a big year for guiding on the mountain, although there were only 12 teams. When I was there in 1983, we were one team on all of Everest. It was 136th person to climb Everest. Now over 4,300 people have climbed Everest. When I was at base camp just after the earthquake and looking at camp. There were 1,200 people camped there. In 1983, there were 33 people camped on the mountain. So now it's 1996, and there's 12 teams. We're going to hear mostly about two teams that are also in the Everest movie. Scott Fisher's team, Mountain Madness, he was an American climber guiding clients, and Rob Hall, a New Zealander from Adventure Consultants. And what happened is we were there with the IMAX team, and so we were all working very closely together. Storm came, 8 people died, 5 on the south side, 3 on the north side. And this is a little bit about our involvement in that year and how we were tasked with getting a 42-pound camera to the top of Everest. People thought it was highly improbable and unlikely and impossible because it's not only a big camera, it used 10 pounds of film, 500 feet of film in 90 seconds. So it's you carried a lot of film, and that's on a mountain where you cut your toothbrush in half to save weight. So we started out, just us, just this team, to climb the mountain, and we're going to go fast. Well, that's for my niece, whenever that's her mascot that we carry around, her little Chief Schnauzer. He's normally not in this presentation, but I forgot he was there. Anyway, that hippo's been all over the world into 25,000 feet. There's the camera. It was a very big camera. I surrounded myself with great people. Robert Schauer had climbed 6 of the world's 14 highest peak. Ed Veister's here, who was with Dave Carter and myself in 1997, has climbed the 14 highest peaks on Earth. And just so you know, they're the 8,000 meter peaks. They're all above 26,250 feet. And his wife that year was our base camp manager at 17,000 feet. I said, Ed, well, I don't really think I can bring Paula, and it's not have you guys at base camp together, team conflict and preferential treatment. So he solved that problem. He got married 2 weeks before. And so that was their honeymoon. Araceli Segarra Roca, 26 years old from Spain, had already climbed to over 27,000 feet. Sumio Tsuzuki from Tokyo, Japan, had climbed a 26,900 foot peak. Experienced climbers. And please note, those 4 people you've just seen are going to be in front of the camera, or 3 of them. It's multi-gender and multi-ethnic. 2 men and 2 women. And here was a man who meant a lot to our team. His name is Jomling Tenzing Norgay, and he meant a lot to me because it was his father who was seeing this picture when I was 11 years old. I had a book about mountaineering and saw this picture, and I just wanted to become a mountaineer, staring at that picture and that book for years. Here's the people that make it happen. You've heard a lot about them. The Sherpas are built to climb and operate at altitude, having evolved at those elevations for years and grew up carrying water and firewood with a band over their foreheads called a tump line and a basket on their backs. So they're strong load carriers, but more importantly, they're good companions. They're marvelous, hardworking, loyal, and cheerful. You walk into a tent here at 25,000 feet or crawl into it, and there they are with their sense of mischief and grins. And just to make it completely clear, there's no IMAX film without the Sherpas on the mountain. We fly our gear up to a point where it used to take 3 weeks to walk. That's a big Russian Mi-17 helicopter. What's important about this photo is all that gear you're looking at. When I looked at it, I was quite daunted because it all came out of the stomach of that helicopter, and that was just the gear for the IMAX film team. And most of those boxes are full of film. 80% of those boxes, and the box on the left in the red is the camera. And of course, we had lots of spare gear, and we'd practice and rehearse this for a year. I forgot to mention in the leadership bit of this that we engage in a lot of scenario planning and really trying to understand worst-case scenarios because those are the ones that hurt the most. But if you've at least thought them through, you know what to do. You don't have to actually do the scenario, and have 8 people die on Everest, but you can say what do you do if a lot of people are injured and there's mass evacuations. Anyway, along the way, we try to put the team, including myself, out there on the rope 300 feet above the stream below, into situations that stress the team. And these stress tests are always useful. They were very useful for me out there on the rope as I learned at 13,000 feet how to manage that camera. I would be managing it at similar situations at 20,000 feet on Everest. Also, you learn who holds on tight to that rope that you're hanging from and who doesn't hang on tight. And those who don't hang on tight, well, you generally say you're not meant for this particular role, and you give them another role, which they might be very good at. We know that term, you choose the right seat on the bus. Not everyone was meant to hold on to that rope. I found that out, but they were much better in the communications department. We walked into the same monastery Hillary and Tenzing walked into. Well, that would have been March of 1953, and we're blessed by the same monk who was the age of this boy looking through the IMAX camera. I don't think he was nearly as hiply dressed and color coordinated as that little kid in his sneakers, but it was wonderful to be blessed by now the 60-year-old Lama who had blessed Hillary and Tenzing. And it's a ceremony that the Sherpas use twice to gain favor to have safe passage on the mountain. We take 10 days to get to base camp. It's a beautiful trek. There's actually a lot of people in this room who have made this trek. We take longer to get to base camp than the average trek because once we get here at the head of the Khumbu Glacier at 17,600 feet, it's our home away from home for 70 days. We don't turn around and go down. And again, psychological security, caring for your team. Even the team said, David, why are we taking 3 extra days to get to base camp? I wanted 3 extra days of acclimatization because we're moving around not only a 30-pound camera, but a 40-pound camera, but the tripod is 75 pounds, and these people need to be fit. Not much has changed at base camp except the quality of the food and the cook tents, but that was our command's station, really. They say an army marches on its stomach. Well, certainly an expedition does, and this is where the Sherpas eat and where their food is prepared and our food is prepared as well. We're in a... there's our head cook, Changba. He's a very, very... He's not actually a very talented cook. In fact, I find most of his food almost inedible. And it's this old leg of yak here. I mean, you don't kill a young yak. You wait till it dies of old age, very old age. You butcher it. You hang that out to dry for 3 months. And when he's done making this meat stew, it's like trying to chew the inside of a golf ball. But the thing is, just remember this. Every position doesn't require maximum talent. Changba is a decent man. He's always happy. And that's invaluable. So we did learn to eat his food, and we had someone help with the other food. We, like everyone in this room, what's nice about this gathering is people are forming bonds maybe they didn't have together around a shared meal. And we're in this tent a lot. That's our base camp tent. And outside, the earth doesn't shake like it did on April 25th, but these big ice avalanches have been crashing down ever since I've been on Everest in 1981. Some of them are quite big. Some are quite, small. Some are quite big like this one. But they do tell you the mountain's a very big place. It's alive and it's full of risks. And we have a puja ceremony at base camp before we go up the mountain. It's a simple ceremony where a lama, a priest, comes up from a monastery and prays from the Tibetan Buddhist texts. And we make offerings to their gods and ask for safe passage. And whatever religion we're talking about here at this moment, it's just a time to show respect and reverence and take pause of how big this mountain is and how small we are on it, and that we need every advantage in getting to the top if we're going to reach the summit, but more importantly, getting down safely. Now I no longer have to point out to you the scale of things here on this mountain because you've just seen it beautifully in that fly-through. But if you pick a place in the middle of the ice fall there, like the third of the way up, I can't use a pointer from here. So then you'll see how big it is in the ice fall because there's our tiny figures making our way through in the morning. People claim it to be quite a dangerous place. I find it more than anything to be exquisitely beautiful. And most of the danger, in fact, from the ice fall is from the huge mountain walls to the side. On one side the wall of the West Shoulder is 5,000 feet high. So that's, you're looking, it's like you're at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and ice can fall from the lip on to your small place, and the mountain wall to the right is 4,000 feet high. So very little danger actually comes from the ice fall itself. People do have died in here because it moves. It's a glacier. It's moving downhill inches a day, and we do have incidents there, and that's me. That's the work I've done now for 35 years in the mountains. That's Sumio on the ladder, who's now speaking to me in a very harsh tone of voice in Japanese that I don't understand a word of, thankfully, because I hasn't been very efficient with my camera moves, and this was take four, and take four was enough for her. And I said to the Sherpa, who's been on many Japanese expeditions, well, what's she up to? And what she's saying about me, and he said, she's saying, you are a really excellent director. Somehow the tone of her voice. So the mountain does a lot of the work for you as a cinematographer. It's beautiful. We have shots like this. Araceli, of course, 26-year-old Araceli, was young and, we could influence her to be the first over the ladder, telling her that was a very prized thing to do, because six brave men standing there off the screen did not want to go over the ladder first. So there went Araceli, but we need to film her from this position. That's the down angle. And I have positioned the camera team there, and you may ask, why are so many people there with me with that camera suspended over that abyss, 300 feet deep? And I have a simple thing and a way to deal with my fears in situations like this. If I have to be there, everybody has to be there with me. One goes and we all go. Now this is the up angle, right? And that's an easy shot. I just get lower down, and the more difficult shot is this, the down angle. It always works. We even used it in the current film, because it's just something about looking down there. Only problem is those aren't Araceli's legs, those are my legs. And I have a 42-pound camera held to my chest, and I couldn't see around it. So I just tapped my way over, and it worked, and the director, the producer, thought I was doing a fine job of acting, whereas actually I was just trying to get my feet to fit on those rungs. I'm afraid of dying on Everest in the wind and that. I'm going to survive that. I don't like down there, you know. So I'm going to have to really go fast, folks. We make our way up the mountain to different camps. We acclimatize along the way. We take 4 weeks of climbing up and down the mountain. It's called climb high, sleep low, to get our bodies, mostly our blood and our respiration rate, into a place where we can climb the mountain. We climb all the way up to 24,500 feet twice and descend to base camp before we are acclimatized enough to reach the top of the mountain. And that's a pretty big rig there of a camera, and I'm hate to admit the fact that along the way one can't always plan for everything. And I work with the IMAX cameras team in Toronto to get this camera from 80 pounds to 42 pounds. The engineers weren't filmmakers. They didn't think of the vibration on the camera. I didn't know that would be a problem. Camera was now so light. When we filmed in high winds and with a long lens, it shook so much that the image would do that on an IMAX screen. So because of my oversight, we had to occasionally carry around a 40-pound rock to put on top of the camera. That's a hard lesson learned. We had an elite camera team, and we just did our work. It's actually quite tedious climbing at high altitudes. One step, five breaths. One step, three breaths. Set up that big camera, do our work. But I have to say, there was a tremendous sense of purpose and commitment and conviction, because we were doing something that seemed like it couldn't be done. This is shooting at 24,000 feet. We've been on the mountain now for 4 weeks, and we're ready to go to the summit. And now I really can't point this out to you, but we're in that upper right. You'll see some ripples on the snow face. We're halfway up there at Camp 3. Ready to head out to the high camp. And we didn't leave the high camp. This was our summit bid. We were going to be the first on the summit. We didn't have to surround ourselves with dozens of other climbers. And also, more importantly than not having other climbers in the frame, in the picture itself, was We didn't want to be surrounded by people we didn't know, who you don't know their competency level. But not only that, like if something happened to me and I happened to be surrounded by people I didn't know and there was a storm, are they going to leave me or are they going to help me? And that's what you know about your companions. Another thing that I really think is important in teams and leadership is you can't follow someone you don't trust. And you can't have teammates you don't trust. And it wasn't that those other climbers might not be good climbers, but I didn't know their behavior, basic behavior characteristics. So we didn't go up that day, and one reason we didn't go up the next day to continue our ascent was there were very high winds, and we looked into these mists below us, and there were 55 climbers coming up. Now, since we weren't leaving camp that day, we would be joined by 56 climbers, and some of them would be climbers we knew, two teams, Mountain Madness, Adventure Consultants, and Rob Hall. And some were just people I recognize their faces. So we decided to go down because we had built in that option to go down. If you don't build in options and wiggle room for your teams, there are times when they will not stop. They just keep going because that's the only way to the finish line. Our team had extra oxygen, extra food. They knew they would have extra salaries. So by going down, they didn't give up on their ascent. On the way down, we met our good friend, the King of Guides, Rob Hall, going up with his team. And the next day, we watched as they all left. That's a 60-degree slope, by the way. It's not level. As we watched as they were all climbing up towards the summit, to the high camp. Now, you leave Camp 3 at 24,700 feet, and you reach the high camp, and you're going to climb... leave that same night and climb through the night to get to the summit while it's still light. And there was an incident that this was one of the first big stress factors on the IMAX team. Someone had fallen and been injured on the Lhotse face. None of this person's companions were there to look out for them, for this person who was injured, but the person soon needed to be evacuated by our upper team. And then we got a call to go out and bring down a body, and we didn't think this person was dead, and the person was actually a fatality on the mountain lying there at the end of the rope. And so that's me in the front and Ed Beister's in the back. And so we had already been up to 24,700 feet three times, and now we're back up at 23,000 feet. And it was a sad task. It was a tiring task for me to bring this man down over these steep Bergschrunds. And finally, on virtually level ground on the glacier, his teammate showed up and started to take his body back down to camp. Now, I say his body because I didn't know who he was. I didn't recognize him. All I knew was there was a lifeless man in a sleeping bag at our feet, and high above us were people with tremendous aspirations and drive and ambition, but not all of that was matched by the experience needed to execute the task they were undertaking. The wind kept blowing. They arrived at the high camp, and the next day, a couple of teams set out for the high camp at night, and were soon at the south summit. You see there to your right at 28,750 feet. And there had been problems that day with rope fixing and people climbing slowly, but we could see the climbers coming and going. We could not communicate with them because we did not share the same radio frequency, but we could walk over to another camp, Rob's camp, and get radio calls. But we became very alarmed when we saw a figure still going up at past 4 p.m. when Rob Hall and his guides always had a turnaround time of 2 p.m. Because if you're on top by 2, you're not going to get down before dark and with oxygen in your tank. So we were quite alarmed to hear that Doug finally reached the top. Rob Hall, his guide, had come down and picked him up a few hundred feet below the top and escorted him to the summit at 4:30. There's no way they were ever going to get down before dark, nor with enough oxygen left in their tanks for the strength and energy and it brings to your and warmth it brings to your body and to your cognitive functioning. So at this time, we started to see a storm coming up, and no one knew the storm was coming, but it was a fierce and ferocious storm, and it started to sweep over the mountain, and it was like something that I've never experienced. But while we started to get calls from above, the Hillary Step at 28,800 feet, that Doug Hansen, the client, had collapsed, and Rob was begging for someone to bring up oxygen. It was a life or death situation. And then a storm with hurricane force winds swept over the mountain, and Rob was left stranded high on the mountain. We got on the radio the next day and learned that Doug had died in the night. His companion, guide, had died in the night. Three Indian climbers had died on the north side. We were not in contact with them. We learned that through satellite phone calls. And two climbers had been left out for the night in the far right-hand side of this frame, Beck Weathers and Yasa Kanamba. And Scott Fisher, a guy I grew up climbing with from when I was 18 years old, was stuck halfway between that big white snow patch and the summit. So it was just chaos on the mountain. Communications were poor. People were out of bottled oxygen. And we went up not to rescue anyone, to do what we could. High up on the pinnacles there of Lhotse, the wind was still blowing at about 70, 75 miles an hour. Rob Hall was stranded, unable to stand up or move at the south summit. He could speak, but he was hypothermic and frostbitten, and he could not coordinate his body to move. But he could get on the radio and communicate with his wife, played in our film by Keira Knightley, who was 7 months pregnant with their first child. And here were the survivors of that terrible storm coming down. And as we weren't really rescuing people, they were self-rescuing. We were giving them tea and moral encouragement. On the way up, my radio came on in my pack, and I pulled it out, and I learned that a team of Sherpas had climbed up the mountain in the hopes of rescuing Scott Fisher, who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal in the movie. And much to our great sadness, our friend, for so many years, had frozen to death in the night. So we kept climbing up the mountain, and to do something, you know, to keep moving, and to keep the teams. I didn't want the team's morale to fall off because of what was happening, and so I wanted them to remain active and engaged. When the radio in my pack came on again a couple of hours later, Rob Hall had been stranded, where I showed you, very close to the summit, unable to move, and three Sherpas had left that morning after the storm, and they had been in the storm and reached the summit. They were quite weary, and they had made a heroic effort to reach him, and less than 300 feet below him, the storm was too intense. They were too tired, and they were becoming frostbitten, so they turned around. So Rob's rescue with oxygen and a sleeping bag and a thermos of water turned around, and he had to be called and informed that that was it, and we knew he wouldn't survive another night. But we kept climbing, and then we got another radio call that a Texan had been left for dead. He's played by Josh Brolin in the movie, Beck Weathers. He'd been left for dead across from the far away from camp. In fact, people had gone out the next day. They'd all wandered off in the storm, and had a bunch of people hadn't gotten back to camp early. Some had made it back later in the evening, and two had been left for dead. They had gone out and checked them, moved them, and called Beck's wife on the sat phone and said he's dead. But we got this radio call, as we're here at 25,300 feet. It said, you won't believe this, David, but the dead guy just walked back into camp. And no one knew who his name was, but we soon found out he was Beck Weathers, and he was brought down the next day to us. And here's Beck when we first met him. Beck had lost his gloves in the night. But he would later lose, these are gory details, but they're the truth, both his hands and most of his nose. But it was left to us, the IMAX team, that's me in the orange in the bottom with Beck's arms on my shoulders, to get him down the steep part of the mountain. And this team's starting to get tired. It's our fifth time to over 24,500 feet. And we put Beck in the helicopter here with the aid of others the next day at 19,800 feet. And it was the highest rescue at that time in Nepal. And it was good to get him out of there because it was going to be a lot of work to get Beck down the icefall. In a few minutes, he was at base camp. And in a few hours, he was back in Kathmandu. And a little bit of us went with Beck, and a lot of Beck stayed with us, because I'm not sure what would have happened that year if he hadn't woken up and saved himself. So we were in base camp now, and base camp was a ghost town. The other teams licked their wounds, counted their dead, and went home. And we were left with the world's highest graveyard above us. And what were we to do? Well, there was, people were, you know, in a psychic storm. I've been through those storms myself after all those years, and I knew that we could go back up the mountain safely. And because those were such sadly clear mistakes that were made, and that storm caught, this is one of those hard lessons from this film, is that whenever you do let your guard down is when something does hit you hard. You know, it seems to never happen when you're hypervigilant. And so there probably wouldn't be another storm like that, but everyone wanted to go home. Not everybody, people whose families could get on the sat phone and beg them to come home. Mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, girlfriends, boyfriends. You know, 8 people were dead. The world knew about it. The world heard this. And so we waited. I gave the team time. At first I didn't, but I don't have time to explain that. I was a very poor leader. I ordered them back up, and they said, you can imagine what they said. It's unprintable. So I said, I have to have another tactic. And what I realized is now we're all going to, we all have to have ownership of this decision. And so we decided to go back up the mountain. And I don't think we went back up to climb the mountain. I wanted to finish my job. And I wanted to do my job. I had been given this responsibility. And if I was to fail and not reach the summit, I wanted it to be because of my own shortness of breath, my own weaknesses, whatever they were, but not because of what had happened. And, you know, there's people, our friends are dead on the trail. I could understand the concerns others had, but I couldn't leave that mountain without going back up. So back up went another team. I have about 4 more minutes, but it says that my time's up. Do you mind if I take 4 more minutes to finish? Oh, good. So it didn't start yelling at me like it normally does, telling me to. So we went back up. It's a weary team, but this is a high-performance team, a team I'll forever be profoundly proud of, because they had been through so much, and the way we heard people die and the way that we knew Rob had named his 7-month-in-the-womb daughter, it was traumatizing. But when you... We maintained the integrity of our vision. We changed the plan. We changed how we were going to execute. But we didn't lose sight of why we were there, how were we going to do it, and why it mattered. So back up we went. It was a bit of a solemn procession, and we waited for 3 days at 21,300 feet for the wind to stop. It wasn't going to stop. And then we picked up that big camera again. Of course, we did no filmmaking during the tragedy. I came under scrutiny for that, but it's just not my nature. You know, I couldn't point a camera at my companions and when I should be helping them. And so we grabbed that camera. Look at the size of that thing. I mean, it's big. And we're going back up a mountain where 8 people just died, and we're taking that up there with us. That's a sign of also in a team of discipline. Good fortitude and discipline. And up we went, and the wind wouldn't stop blowing. We got to the high camp now where all those others had been camped 2 weeks earlier. It was May 10th they died. It was now May 23rd. We were going to make our summit bid. And then I had a very difficult task. One of our team members had developed a very deep cough that you get at altitude during our time down the mountain. And this coughing had caused them to crack a rib. It's not uncommon up there. And they were coughing all night, and they weren't sleeping, and their performance had gone down. And one of the most painful things I've ever had to do on a mountain, or leading on a mountain, was this. This was a Japanese woman, the first woman to climb Everest was Japanese. And she was an iconoclast. She didn't want to be a so-called Japanese office girl. And that's not a derogatory term. That's a term used for women in Japan who typically occupy low-level positions as secretaries. She stepped out of that world and was making her way. And now all eyes of Japan were upon her. And she would have gone from an iconoclast to a hero. And I got into the tent and pulled that door open. And she knew what I was going to say. And I was met with a wall of tears. And I told her, you can't go. And she said, why are you punishing me? I said, Sumi, I'm not punishing you. She said, let me try. Please let me try. I said, I can't, Sumio, because you can't climb fast enough. And if you're not with us, we can't care for you. And also, I have an obligation to the team, and I have an obligation to you. And it's not to get you to the summit. Now, that was really hard to do, because we not only broke her dream, our unit was missing someone when we left the tent at 11 p.m. that night. And so I had to, my source of strength, doing something that was profoundly just upsetting to me, was that I owed it to her and I owed it to the team and not to her aspirational goal. So up we went, and boy, I'll tell you, it's cold at night. It was minus 39, and we're almost done here. And it's wonderful to see the sun, ever a shadow cast on the upper atmosphere, and to know the sun will soon be on you, and to look out at Makalu. It's a small mountain. It's 27,900 feet high. And further off in the distance, 80 miles away, is the world's third highest mountain. It's only 28,100 feet high. But there we were on our way on a beautiful day, looking up. The summit seems close, but at this point you're only halfway there. Looking down, I could see Jomling climbing where his father had climbed 43 years earlier, and I could remember my headlamp falling on this blue object and me being completely perplexed at finding my friend Scott Fisher. I knew he would be there, but it was a big question of why this strong climber who'd climbed K2 and Everest before without bottled oxygen had not managed to get himself down the mountain. And we put up the camera, 27,600 feet, and with tremendous discipline and efficiency, we shot one roll of film and carried on. We shot much less than we planned to on that day. We changed the rules. And finally, we were standing on the south summit. Beautiful day. This is not hard climbing. It's exposed climbing, but over the years, most of us have done it without fixed ropes. The fixed ropes are now there for the clients. We didn't film there. I had to make a decision on the team's safety. This is going to be hard for all of you to see, not in terms of a hard thing, but hard to point out. But we're on the south summit. There's 10 of us. If to the right of that person's boot, it's pointing right at a dark shadow with a curl over it. You see that? A curl of snow. Can anyone see down in that shadow a little bit of red? That's Rob. So that's where we found Rob Hall. And thankfully, his face was covered. And I sat there with my friend waiting for the rest of the team, because I would go ahead and scout camera positions. And the only thing was, what are you doing here? You know what? And then I looked at, and later over the years, I realized it was his humanity, as his intent was good to get Doug to the top, Doug who had failed the year before. But I learned that lesson, and I have turned people around. I have turned myself around before. You know, that the disciplined thinking, get away from that willful ignorance. He would not be there if he had turned Doug around. And that was his own rule he broke. So we got up to the top, and there was Ed, who had climbed without bottled oxygen. He had climbed ahead of us. I wanted him to be in the film in a big way. Amazing achievement. He climbed past two of his best friends. Both had died climbing with bottled oxygen. And he had decided to do what he planned to do for the film, to climb without bottled oxygen. That's the only picture we ever have of him on the summit in the IMAX film, because the integrity of the vision was there, but also the plan had changed. He was without bottled oxygen. The camera was behind, so he headed down to base camp and to safety and to his wife. And that's how we kept, you know, the integrity of the moral approach to the mountain. The film mattered less now than his safety. We turned on the camera. We filmed up there for, I had one roll of film left, 90 seconds. And we have it on a monopod now. And man, we just said, please work, camera. I mean, it sounds like a lawnmower. I mean, it uses 6 feet of film per second. And you have to load it perfectly. And we're at 29,028 feet. I have a checklist taped to my chest, and I read it, and I go, turn it on. 6 feet of film per second goes ripping through that camera to record Jomling standing where his father had stood 43 years earlier, and Araceli Segarra, the first Spanish woman to climb Everest. And you don't know how much this means to me for a film that's been seen by 130 million people, and a lot of those, most of it's in science theaters. And so half those people in that audience is, are not just young boys, they're young girls. And they could look at Araceli on top and didn't know what I really knew, but she was twice as strong a climber as Jomling. She kind of wrecked it for the premiere in Madrid because she's from Barcelona. She's a Catalan. And so I'm just teasing, but she's got the Catalan flag there, not the Spanish flag. So we got ourselves back down to base camp in 3 days, filming on the way down. And I was a relieved leader, mostly relieved and proud. The pride would set in later, but I wouldn't have to leave it, lead a team into harm's way for 70 days. And so that's our last slide. And so we left the mountain that year full of questions. And the biggest one was came from Ed Viesters when I was on a pass looking back at the great mountain on the way out. And he asked, how do we do it? First, people said we could never get that camera to the top. And that was a daunting thing to set out to do. And then people died along the way. And we brought down the Taiwanese climber. And we still got up the mountain with that monstrous thing. And that by then had plenty of unprintable nicknames. I asked Ed, how did that all work? And he said, well, we never forgot why we were there. And we never failed to take care of each other. And sometimes, everyone, it's as simple as that. Thank you very much. Do I have time for questions?
We're supposed to end at 1:30.
So I went over by 4 minutes. So I'll have to answer your questions by tweeting back to you.
Well, thank you so much, David, for that incredible talk and the life lessons that you shared with us. We promised to end at 1:30, and it's a little bit past that, so I hope you don't mind that David spoke a little longer than sometimes is the case, and we'll skip the Q&A session today. But David will stick around and is delighted to answer your questions, but we are very grateful, David, for your incredible comments. Today's presentation will be rebroadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 on Saturday, November 4th, and is also available to download on WFYI.org. And we hope you'll come back next month on November 10th, where we are very excited to welcome David Brooks, the New York Times journalist, PBS commentator, and author, and who is one of the most important thinkers of our time. And we are pleased that the Lilly Endowment is bringing us David Brooks. So we hope to see you next November 10th. Thank you so much for being here today.
You've been listening to a speech from David Brashears, part of the 2015-2016 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for a speech from David Brooks, New York Times op-ed columnist. You can find more information online at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us.